Welcome to the LP Lounge, presented by Hip Dad Radio. If you are looking to discover new music, appreciate older tunes, or learn more about your favorite bands, this is the place for you. Come on in and take a seat with your host, Reed Rinaldi. Every week, we will peel back the curtains, giving you an intimate look at the lives and creative processes of musicians. Now let's dive into some music.
Welcome back to the LP Lounge, brought to you by Hip Dad Radio. Today we're sitting down with Moon King, the synth pop project of Daniel Benjamin, originally from Toronto, Canada. He's released several albums on Montreal label Arbitus Records Recordings, including most recently a collaboration with Detroit artist Vesper and a 12-inch of new mixes by DJs including Cooper Saver and Patrick Holland. Daniel has toured and traveled extensively over the years and has spent his time living in Toronto, Montreal, Detroit, and Amsterdam. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, good, man. So for our audience who is tuning into the podcast, for this will probably be the second episode, if they don't know, Moon King was the act that we booked on the launch party for Hip Dad Radio like 2 summers ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was amazing. That was such a fun party.
That was definitely like one of the most successful parties we've ever thrown.
Definitely. It was really refreshing for me also because, you know, a lot of the time I get booked for things and it, you know, it'll be at a regular venue at a bar or whatever. And you guys just kind of hit me up out of the blue and we're like, come and play, like, you know, in this like basement warehouse space, basically.
Yeah. If you were like 6 foot, your head was hitting the ceiling down there.
Yeah. But it was so much fun. I mean, it basically took me back to playing all the kind of like DIY type venues that were in Toronto, you know, when I was growing up or when I started playing music. And I really missed that. So it was really refreshing.
That's awesome. We had a lot of fun. Definitely some fond memories of that night.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, we went to go see you play when you performed an Empty Bottle a couple months later.
Yeah.
And I remember that show was on like a Monday or a Tuesday. And I think there were like 20 people at the Empty Bottle. And our crew, the Hip Dad Radio, was like half the people. And you're like, come on stage and dance with me for the last song.
Hell yeah.
And so half the crowd went on stage with you.
Yeah, I like Empty Bottle. I don't know why it was on a Monday, but like the that venue is actually pretty great. I feel like I've played at Shuba's like a bunch of times and then Empty Bottle maybe once. And Empty Bottle, I think, has got to be my fave. No shade to Shuba's, but Empty Bottle was amazing.
I'm with you. My girlfriend actually lives a couple blocks away from Shuba's and she moved there in the middle of quarantine. So I haven't gotten a chance to just like walk over and see a show, which I'm a little disappointed about.
Yeah, all of the venues that I've played in Chicago have all been pretty solid. It reminds me the most of Toronto of any city. Like, it feels very familiar. I've always kind of liked that. Plus, it's not too far away, so I get to come back pretty often. So, I mean, depending on how things go with the pandemic, then hopefully I'll be able to come back. There's been a couple of people from Chicago have, like, written me being like, you know, we're excited for you to come back whenever it's possible.
Well, if you ever want to play another basement party, we're happy to set that up.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Awesome. Yeah, it was cool. You guys had turntables set up too. Like, it felt like a proper, it was like a proper party, like a keg of beer or something. It was like a lot of booze. But yeah, it was cool. So yeah, thanks for having me down. I mean, hopefully we can do it again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Fingers crossed. Now, typically I reserve this question for the first one, but because we have a history, I had to talk about other things. But my first official question is, what was the first ever live show you went to on your own choosing, not something you got dragged to by your parents?
Yeah. I remember really well, actually, because it was 2003. Me and my brother bought tickets to go see the Vines because they had just put out their first album.
Yeah.
And it was, we were like slightly too young to get on the like Strokes wave. Like, I think like my older friends in high school were more into them. And then we were like coming up a bit later and we're like, oh, there's this other band. In hindsight, it's so funny because that whole era of music was like, that was like kind of the end of major label world when they were trying to sell bands as being kind of indie. That was like the selling point for those artists.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they were very much still entrenched in like major label, old school music world. And I mean, I thought it was great. Like it was like probably the first big rock show I ever went to at a venue in Toronto too. It was kind of like in the 90s, it was like the classic like big rave warehouse. And then they converted it into doing more like live stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it was a cool experience. I smoked weed for like, I don't know, third time or something like that. Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
Well, I did a little digging during my free time today, and I got to ask you, does the name Spiral Beach mean anything to you?
Yeah, for sure. That was my band from 2003 or 2004 until like, which is crazy, right? That I have a band. As soon as I started going to shows, me and my brother started this band together. And then we went until 2009. And then me and Maddie from that band started Moon King a few years later. But that was very much like my introduction to music and the way I met all of my, I guess what I would call like my, you know, band friends, like people in the music scene in Toronto. And went on tour for the first like 3 or 4 times.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool. How old were you when you did your first tour?
We started, I think, when I was 15 or maybe, maybe 16. And I guess, yeah, because I was in high school for the first 2 years of the band and then maybe 4 years afterwards. So it was kind of like, it's funny because my memory of it is mostly about the community that we kind of like, I feel like we were embraced by a lot of people who were mostly older than us at the time. But then we also introduced a lot of people who were our age or even younger into going to shows and especially going to like DIY type shows. The main focus of the band for me at least was like finding venues that were kind of interesting and putting on like a real, like a show, you know, like a multimedia type of thing, which would not have been possible if it was just like a couple of people in a rock band or whatever. Mm. Like it was mostly about, there was like a whole crew of people who would all set up the shows with us and like kind of like be part, like be, you know, partying and dancing and stuff. And I feel like we were also young that like there was definitely some drugs and stuff involved. It wasn't like hedonistic, like, you know, 20-year-olds like fucked up and like partying. It felt very innocent. And it was really cool that a lot of the people who were involved with that community went on to be in bands or artists or just kind of very involved people, even to the point that a friend of mine who I grew up with posted a link to a Spiral Beach video last week on Facebook. And all these people like kind of like came out of the woodwork, you know, like that happens on Facebook anyway. It's like,
yeah,
you went to high school with, like, you haven't thought about him forever, but like there were all these people that posted really nice stuff about it. And I just kind of haven't really thought about it for a long time because it was, you know, it was like 12 years ago. And seeing that sort of, it meant something to people, even though the band itself was very silly and it's kind of like a B-52s type band. Like it was sort of a new wave, maybe like trippy new wave, I guess would be the best way to describe it. It was cool that that resonated with people so many years later. And like, I honestly felt very kind of like touched by that. Like I was like, if I was able to tell my past self that people would still be thinking about this that much later, I would have made myself very happy.
That's awesome. I don't know if you know this, but the audio for Voodoo by Spiral Beach is like, I think over 150,000 views on YouTube right now.
Really? I mean, yeah. But it was probably, that was probably uploaded at that time. Because the band was, I feel like also, this is, I've been talking about this with a couple of friends of mine, where it was like, I don't know how old you are, but like MySpace era was, like there's a bunch of bands, and I feel like my old band was included in that, that were definitely like MySpace era bands. Like not in like the fashion or like taking the photos from a certain angle or whatever, but more just the rise and fall of the platform coincided with the rise and fall of the bands. And like, when I think about the timing, it like is kind of really similar, you know, like I think at the time we were totally getting, like we got most of our audience or most of our like new audience that had never seen a show was coming from MySpace. And it's funny to think about it. Like that was a band that existed before Facebook, which is really tricky.
I'm a little younger than you. So I was kind of like getting on social media right at the end of the MySpace mm-hmm. way and more towards Facebook. And then our parents were like, oh, you can't have a Facebook unless you're friends with us. And then I haven't used Facebook since, you know?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I'm in the same. A couple of years ago, I just like unfollowed everybody and everything on Facebook. And when I go on, I mean, it's like nothing against any people in particular. I just like, I think it's poisonous. When I go on Facebook, I literally don't see anything. It's like a blank slate, which is, I think it's pretty amazing. It's like,
yeah,
it's like, it's really nice. I still use other platforms, but I do think that like, the Facebook algorithm in particular have directed people in such a negative way.
I agree. That
I don't really, I would rather just not participate, you know?
Yeah, I think that's smart. So when and how did you transition from Spiral Beach to Moon King?
So the band put out 2 records and we did get to tour a bunch, although this was before I ever had a visa to come to America. So almost all the touring was in Canada, which like Canada is really big. And every band in Canada, when you go on tour, you basically go in a straight line across the whole country. Like some people would say like Canada kind of looks like America's hat if you look at the population.
Yeah.
Pretty much everybody, not, you know, the majority of population of Canada is condensed into kind of like a straight line from Vancouver all the way over to Halifax. And when you go on tour, that's what you do. And the distance between cities is sometimes can be like up to like 10 or 12 hours to get from one town to the next.
Wow.
So when I started touring in America and then eventually in Europe, I was like, oh man, like this is great. Like you only, like to get to Chicago from Detroit, it's only 4 hours. That's amazing. I felt like the Canada touring prepped me in a good way to be able to tour outside of it. And also like there's a ton of really cool, weird towns in Canada that like I haven't really been since then. Like Spiral Beach played to St. Marie like 3 or 4 times. That's a cool town. Like we played in Red Deer, Alberta, played in Kelowna, BC, all over the East Coast of Canada, which Moon King's still never really been. Played in Sackville, New Brunswick. And, you know, like, I feel like I got a really cool experience by being in a band at that time, at that age. And then we went until 2009. And then the band broke up, which, you know, that's what happens, especially to like a high school band that's been around for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
And then my brother was living in a loft space called Everlasting Joy in Toronto that ended up being kind of one of the pivotal kind of like DIY venues around what I maybe would call like kind of like the Dan Deacon era of like DIY shows and stuff, where we were getting a lot of people from Baltimore up and a lot of people from New York. And they're sort of like a scene kind of coalesced with a lot more electronic music. It wasn't really dance music. It was electronic music. And so Eric started a project called Doldrums, which was based in that loft space. And then eventually he started putting out records and, you know, put out a record on Sub Pop and did a whole bunch of stuff with that. And then around that time, I started making music on my own, which was, you know, kind of like a, I guess it's kind of like a big deal because prior to that, I was mostly just a drummer and me and my brother would write songs together. And for me to even learn how to play guitar enough to write a song was kind of like a big deal. I think that's why I started the Moon King Project, was just as an outlet to see if I could make music by myself. Yeah, I really started just doing super basic guitar stuff, like mostly influenced by like the Ramones and the Pixies and stuff like that. And very quickly asked my friend Maddie, who was also in Spiral Beach, so we had grown up together and everything, asked her to be kind of, you know, like the other half of the band. I did most of writing and stuff by myself, but like the band was very much like the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we played a ton of shows, sometimes just the two of us with some electronic stuff, and then eventually kind of transitioned it into a full band with, like, you know, guitars and drums and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's awesome. In my digging today, I listened to some stuff from you that I had never heard before.
Mm.
I listened to your Obsessions 1 and 2 demo.
Yeah.
And I really like attached to tracks like Icarus, Glass, and cool. Almost Blue. And it's nothing like you're making right now, obviously. I can tell that your move to Detroit really influenced your music, but definitely pre-Hamtrak, it was like a lot of synth pop, alternative rock, new wave, like maybe a little bit of punk kind of stuff. And it actually reminded me a lot of Cocktail Twins from
Scarlet. Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, Cocktail Twins are, you know, been a fan of them since high school. And I love the sound of the guitars, like the sort of chorused out guitars and stuff.
Yeah, I can totally see the guitars.
And even though I'm making kind of more music with synths and stuff now, like I still kind of think that that's the basis for a lot of the sounds that I use. You know, like if you put a Juno synth through like a pitch shifter in the same way or a chorus, then it kind of still has, it ends up sounding like it has a similar kind of like ethereal feel to it. And as a non-guitar player, because I was like just learning how to play guitar, I always approached making guitar music as if I was playing keyboards or more just like textures.
That's an interesting way to approach it.
Yeah, so the Moon King stuff, even when it was a guitar band, the guitars kind of just sound like big texture generators with effects on them. Like there's not, like definitely listen to Cocteau Twins, My Bloody Valentine, like I don't know. Oh yeah, and also the records were put out by Mike from Fucked Up, who put out, he had a label at that time called One Big Silence. And Fucked Up have a kind of similar attitude towards guitars for their band. They're coming at like punk rock, but using the guitars basically as this big wall. And I was definitely inspired by that for sure. Like I've been to see Fucked Up like millions of times. And then we ended up doing a little tour with them and working with Mike to put out the records and stuff. So yeah, I mean, I know what you mean. There's there's definitely like a feeling with Cocteau Twins, it's kind of like translated into a lot of music that I make.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said the guitars because that totally validated what I said. When I heard the guitar album for Glass specifically, I was like, Oh my God, this sounds just like Cocteau Twins. This is like, it's like they're playing the same guitar and they're using all the same pedals and everything.
Yeah, that was like 12-string guitar or like two 12-string guitars through some chorus and stuff. And the other thing in that song is like I had read something about like people said like My Bloody Valentine sounded like a vacuum cleaner. And I was like, well, that's pretty cool. Like, why don't I just put a vacuum cleaner on the song? And so I just like recorded a vacuum cleaner and mixed it with the guitars.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. It's like, that. I don't know, like take it literally, you know?
All right. I'm sitting here with the LP of Secret Life in front of me. I don't know if you know how many of those exist, because I would imagine it's probably not a lot.
Yeah, I don't, actually, yeah, I don't know. that we put out on Last Gang Records. And yeah, to be honest, I don't know how many they are, but that's cool that you've got one.
I think it's cool. I was just digging through Suga, which is a record store by us here in Chicago, and I saw that and I had to buy it. They also had Vita Eterna. I didn't pick it up for whatever reason.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of just gravitated towards this. So I picked that up actually after you performed for us, and I had never heard it. And I played it, and I was like,
"Yeah, yeah." And you're like, "What the fuck? This is
Moon King. I think this is a different Moon King. Like, this does not sound anything like he played.
Yeah,
it sounds like indie folk for the most part. Actually, like you guys harmonize on like every single song.
Yeah, I think the harmonies were very much like the basis of the band. Like that was like." Me and Maddie have been sort of singing together since we were kids, basically, or at least working. I never, because in Spiral Beach, our old band, I never sang, but I wrote a lot of the vocals. Mm-hmm. And the ability to harmonize with somebody else is a pretty cool, I don't know, special thing. And once we figured out that we could do that, it was like, well, that's the basis of the band. It doesn't really matter what kind of music it is. So the band Moon King has kind of transitioned probably four or five times, like going from me writing songs on an acoustic guitar just to have them to play to like basically like a shoegaze band, and then to like, I don't know, disco and house music and all sorts of different stuff. But I think that when it comes down to it, basically what it is me writing vocal parts. Everything else can kind of transition into whatever. But I think that's the center of it, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's good that you feel flexible about it. And, you know, when somebody says, like, somebody comes up to me, they're like, oh, Moon King played it, like, your party, like, I wouldn't point them in the direction of this album just not because it's not good, but because it's not really the sound of what you're currently making, with the exception of the song Roswell, actually.
Yeah, And, like, there's the reason why we put that first.
Yeah.
The reason why we put that first was kind of like, by the time we actually put the record out, I was kind of like, I think this is the direction this project is going.
I didn't know that. Wow. I
feel like even maybe the first tour, so we did a tour with Dive right before I sort of, I guess before the Hamtramck thing came out, and I think we were still playing Roswell, but had ditched the guitars and stuff. So,
whoa, I'd love to hear how that sounds, actually. I've only heard it with the guitar.
Yeah, yeah, it was cool. Because it's basically, you know, one synth arpeggio that goes through the whole thing. And then the guitars just fill up space. So I just replaced the guitars with keyboards. Yeah, that was cool. I'm glad you picked up on that. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sticks out like a sore thumb on that album. Right, I could right, not. Right, right. And then you moved to Detroit in 2016 to a town called
Hamtramck.
Hamtramck. Yeah, okay. So when I started listening to you, I was introduced to, you know, the Hamtramck tape, and I just thought it was Hamtrak for the longest time.
Yeah, there's definitely been, that's a common.
Yeah. I did a little research on the town, and I know like how incredibly diverse it is. And before we get into the music, I have to ask if the Al Ishal, I don't know how to pronounce it, Islamic Center is still broadcasting the call to Islamic prayer over the speakers.
Yeah. Now. Oh, they are. It was very much like a regular occurrence during the day that you would hear that broadcasting all over the area of the town is only a couple square miles. I'm sure you probably did some research and stuff, but just for people listening, it's one of the highest density areas, especially for Muslim people living in America. And there's a ton of people from Yemen there and also Bangladesh. To me, coming from Toronto, which is already very multicultural, like extremely multicultural, but coming to Hamtramck, which is a very small little area, but has a population that seemed to be kind of like equal parts, like Bengali, Yemenis, Polish, and just kind of like a mix of people. I was kind of blown away, and it was incredibly refreshing to see something like that in America. Even the city council of Hamtramck is majority Muslim, which is incredible. So, you know, living in this environment, also just to be clear, Hamtramck is in the center of Detroit geographically. Hamtramck and Highland Park are kind of like, they're technically separate cities, but they're bordered by Detroit. I felt like I was getting a really interesting picture of America that I had never experienced before. And I mean, to me also kind of like an idyllic place in the center of, you know, an area that has a lot of issues. Detroit is definitely like not taken care of by its government. I was very inspired being there. So it was cool. That's awesome. You did some research into it too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think you came and you played in our neighborhood, and even our neighborhood in Chicago, we're pretty close to downtown, isn't extremely diverse. We're in Wicker Park, Bucktown area, and it's predominantly white. But, you know, if you go just a couple miles down the road to some other neighborhoods, then it's like predominantly Hispanic. And the general population of Chicago, it is pretty diverse. It's the second largest Polish population in the world. There's all different nationalities here, but neighborhood to neighborhood, it's relatively separated. And, you know, part of that is part of gentrification. And, you know, obviously part of me feels guilty, like to an extent, living in a neighborhood like that. But I think now with like the Black Lives Matter protests going on, there's hopefully going to be a bigger transition here soon to integration within the communities.
Yeah, that would be like the goal. And if people can fight against environmental racism in that way in a long term, that would be incredible. It's like the deck is stacked in the wrong direction. Like there are forces at work that are trying to separate people.
Yeah.
And, you know, keep certain populations down. And I think that is present in Canada as well. I don't want to like make it seem like Canada is somehow removed from that discussion, right? There's protests here, not as many as there should be, but they have been happening. And I grew up downtown Toronto, which is like, as I said, like very, very diverse. You know, I grew up kind of in Koreatown. There's like a huge like Caribbean population. And that's what I grew up in the middle of, is this kind of like mix of like Korean people, Hungarian people, Chinese and Korean people. That seems to coexist pretty well in Toronto for the most part. But there are areas of Canada for sure that have been dealing with the systemic racism that exists in America for, you know, decades and decades. It's the same stuff.
Yeah. I would like to talk a little more about Detroit and Hamtramck. Mm-hmm. And there was a video I watched like a couple years ago of the band Tops, who I know that you know them.
Yeah, super well, yeah.
Playing at this place in Detroit called the Old Tire Factory. And I tried looking it up everywhere online and I couldn't find it, but I know this venue exists. And
I
want you to tell me what the deal with that is.
Yeah, I think, well, I don't think it exists anymore. If it's the same venue that we're talking about, it went through a couple different name changes. And I actually, it's funny actually that you mentioned that. Like my introduction to Detroit was, I mean, I guess I had played a couple shows there, but my introduction to, you know, the community there was, there was an Arbutus, Arbutus is the label that releases my music. They're in Montreal. And there's bands like Tops, Braids, Blue Hawaii, Sean Nicholas Savage. And I guess like one night in August 2015, essentially all of those bands played in Detroit.
Wow.
That was sort of like a mini festival that the label organized. And I was actually just literally passing through. I think I was on my way back from being on tour in Chicago, actually. Yeah, I was doing a tour with Mr. Twin Sister. And we ended up the last day being in Chicago. So I drove through Detroit on my way back and I figured like, hey, like all my friends from Montreal are playing this show. I'll just like go hang out. And I ended up meeting a lot of Detroit people there and got introduced to some music and stuff. And I ended up moving there about a couple months later.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that was cool. That was a pivotal night, right?
That is a pivotal night. I mean, think about how much it probably influenced your music too.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, I would say that living there and going to hear DJs, just playing at bars and stuff locally, introduced me to so much music that I connected with. Like, it's funny, like having been in bands and stuff for years and then discovering music, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like it was a total, like, second wave for me. And I basically spent all of 2016 just listening to records and going to record shops in Detroit. And my roommate at the time, too, who I made some music with as well, he worked for, like, a distribution company that did, they released a ton of Detroit techno stuff. That kind of introduced me to that side of the community there. So I felt like when I was learning to DJ in our apartment, I had access to all these records because my roommate would get them from his job. That's basically how I got into dance music.
That's pretty cool. So obviously you picked up a new set of influences. And mm-hmm. Like, what were some of the big names that you started listening to that drove you to write this new music?
Man, I mean, like as soon as I got in there, I was introduced to like Marcellus Pittman, Omar S., I guess, like Fitz Siegel, who was the guy who ran the distribution company. He is also like an amazing producer. I saw him play a few times too. Or he lives in New York now, actually, but he's a great DJ. And then some of my friends who I was hanging out with are also some of my favorite DJs. So like Ryan Spencer, who played drums with me and Moon King a lot. Scott Zacharias is probably like, you know, my all-time fave. Bill Spencer, Andra, Cruz, Izzy, Mike Meadow. Fuck, there's like a whole lot.
You could go on forever.
Yeah, I could go on for a long time. But honestly, like all the music that I heard there, it definitely changed me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. My stepdad grew up in Detroit. He grew up on 7 Mile.
Yeah.
You know, he was grown up, he was born in like the late 50s. And so he lived there through the disco era. Mm-hmm. And he is very picky about what he listens to. Like, I think the only new musician he listens to is like Bruno Mars. You know, he kind of likes that.
Yeah, word. All right.
Kind of thing. But there was, after you played our show, I was telling my family about it. And I played In and Out from you guys. Mm. To him, and he was like, this is great. This is awesome.
Yeah, because it sounds like Bruno Mars. Fuck yeah.
Not that it sounds like Bruno Mars, but like,
no, I mean, I
derive from like disco.
See, Bruno Mars also is influenced by, well, obviously, he's hugely influenced by like Michael Jackson and Prince and stuff, but he also has a track that sounds like Zap. And like, I feel like he's taking a lot of stuff from the funk era and just putting, you know, like modern production on it and stuff.
Yeah.
And like, I, you know, like I grew up with a bunch of different music, but in Toronto, we don't really get a lot of like, we basically don't get a ton of like black music on the radio in the way that they do in Detroit or Chicago. I grew up with like a lot of like Indian music on the radio that would be played on, you know, like a college station and stuff, and Jamaican music. So it was cool to me to like, I feel like when I moved to Detroit and realized that like a lot of the music that I liked already was inspired by Detroit music, that really like blew the doors wide open. And from then on, it was just kind of like discovery after discovery. Also just like hearing people's stories and stuff, that was also really inspiring. You know, actually there's a friend of mine who lives in Hamtramck, actually born and raised in Hamtramck, who was around in the disco era also, and was telling me about going to see bands. Like he the Romantics, who like the singer from the Romantics was in, he was a Hamtramckian as well. And he was telling me about like going to see like garage rock shows in Detroit in the late 70s. And then he told me about going to see Kraftwerk when they came to Detroit in like 81 or 82, I think. And that Kraftwerk show, when you think about it, that is like a pivotal event in music, period. Because this is when a whole lot of Detroiters who, you know, Kraftwerk was selling records, like those records were around and available. But I don't think a lot of people had realized that it was like four German white dudes. And for them to like come to Detroit where they had an audience that was like definitely like black and beginning to use drum machines and synthesizers in a way that was inspired by Kraftwerk. So that show, Kraftwerk at the Masonic Temple, it must have been a pretty pivotal event for like people like Juan Atkins, who were beginning to make electronic music. So just, I mean, just for me, like as like random Canadian dude just showing up and hearing these stories, is pretty amazing. Like I'm lucky to have even been hearing about this firsthand, you know, yeah. Secondhand.
Yeah, you definitely have a pretty high acumen when it comes to Detroit music. I can tell that.
I don't know about that.
Well, I mean, well, you're talking about a lot of stuff that I've never heard of.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, also Chicago too, though. Like a lot of the stuff that I gravitated towards when I started getting into dance music was actually Chicago. Like Chicago House has probably influenced me directly more than like by, you know, I have a couple of songs where I was really trying to think of it as like a house tune. And I recorded a song with my friend Kaylin, who she's from Detroit and records and performs as Vesper. And I recorded a song with her last year that we just put out a couple months ago. And I was trying to think of that as like the type of collaboration that would have existed in Chicago in the house music era, where it was like this, I'm just taking the role of a producer, like straight up. And then she is the singer, and like my, my fingerprints are on it, but it's like her, you know, it's her tune. I'd love to do more of that. I think that to me is, that's where my head is at. I'd love to be more of a producer and work with different vocalists. That's been kind of like, I feel like that's where I'm headed.
You know, I'm just glad that you're still making music, man. You're killing it.
Yeah, of course. At this point, yeah, this is another thing that's like been interesting with the quarantine and having this much time to sort of consider things, right? Mm-hmm. Because I've never had this much time to just think about my life or whatever. And the narrative of things has been interesting to me. Like, thinking about, especially like even this conversation, like starting from when I was 15 and getting interested in music and having a band, and then starting to make my own music, and then moving, looking at what is now kind of like a 15-year period, looking at it from almost kind of like an outside perspective, because right now nothing is happening and I'm just sitting in my room. No tours, there's no shows or anything. Looking at it from kind of like almost as an outsider, and seeing the narrative of it is pretty interesting. It can tell you a lot about yourself by getting a bit of perspective like that. And I mean, the pandemic sucks, but like, you know, this is one of the small benefits or silver linings where I'm like, I'm thinking about where I want to go and what I want to do from a bit of like, maybe a bit of like a higher place. And that's kind of cool.
I would like to talk to you a little bit about the music video for In and Out, which is one of my favorites
of all time.
Yeah. It's a really cool animation. I'm actually going to provide a link to the video in the show notes. So if you're listening to this, go check it out. It features a roller skating dog smoking a joint, which is really cool. And I know that, you know, disco is pretty big in Detroit. And I know that like roller skating is also big there too.
Well, there is, I never got to go, but there is there's like a roller disco that Moody Man plays at every there's like a big festival called Movement there. And every year, Moody Man does like a disco, roller disco thing. Sounds amazing.
I've always wanted to go to a roller disco. I worked at a Domino's like way out in the Northwest suburbs a while ago. When I started working there, I was making a delivery to like some store in like an outlet mall, and across the street was a roller disco that went out of business a month before I started working at Domino's, which was really sad. I was like, oh, well, I mean, it makes sense that a place like that wouldn't survive in like the suburban Northwest suburbs of Chicago, but
it's
a bummer that, I mean, I can't find any place like that. There's got to be one in Chicago.
Yeah, I feel like in Chicago there might be some like holdouts from that era, because, you know, like disco was so big. Mm-hmm. I have never been to one. I would love to. I did get to play an actual ice rink last year though, in Paris, in France. That was incredible. Yeah,
did you just like play in the middle of the ice rink, or were you like off behind the glass?
Yeah, it was for this festival, and they had me set up literally right in the middle of the rink, and then all these people were skating around like that. You know, like they had like a current, like it was skating in one direction all around me. It was pretty surreal. I got to play for like 2 or 3 hours.
That's really cool, actually. That's a pretty unique experience.
Yeah, I felt like super blessed. Like I don't even know if that was on my list of stuff I wanted to do, because it just seemed like something like that would never happen. But that was incredible. Check that one off.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you speak French? I know you're from Canada.
No, I do not. Okay. We all take French in school. Some of us retain it. Others do not.
Is it mandatory in Canada to take French in school?
Yeah, or at least in Ontario it is. Western Canada, I'm actually not sure, but I think it probably is. I don't know. But yeah, you take French all through grade school, and then kind of about halfway through high school, it becomes optional. You know, like this is the thing about Canada, is like a lot of artists and bands and stuff all moved to Montreal and Quebec, which is majority French. But it's really hard to find a job there if you don't speak French. So there's kind of like a lot of people move there to go to school or to do art. And then once they realize they can't really like integrate, they move away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you can't speak the language that a lot of people speak there, I would imagine that's a big deterrent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, otherwise I probably would have moved to Montreal when I was 20 or something. But I stayed in Toronto for the most part until 2015. I moved to Detroit. Yeah.
So where does the song I've Stopped Believing come in? Because it's not on any of your records.
That is actually about the gentrification process in Toronto, which is like wild and like pretty extreme even for a big city. So I did that. There's that one, and then another track called Apartment Fire that I recorded in 2017 and then released as a single. But yeah, that one's cool. I kind of just ripped off like Superstition by Stevie Wonder. And it has that kind of same like triplet groove kind of thing.
Yeah,
the lyrics for it are just kind of about, it's like, you know, glass towers and all this stuff, because like I grew up in a neighborhood that it looks completely different now than when I was a kid. Like it gentrified hardcore, you know.
So were you still living in Hamtramck when you released Voice of Lovers, or at least when you wrote it?
Definitely when I wrote it. I think I was, where was I? I kind of like, I moved back to Toronto for a bit, and then I basically went on tour all of last year. Like I was pretty much either on tour or just traveling from March until like November or something. And then my partner actually lives in Amsterdam, so then I split and went to Amsterdam after that. No, I was not in Hamtramck.
All right. And then I would like to move on to a little more of your current stuff. I know Vesper was on Voices of Lovers as well. She was on Neon Lights, and you just released, what was it, like 2 months ago, another song with her?
Yeah.
Seconds from You?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we had recorded a bunch of stuff for Voice of Lovers, and then it ended up being, like, I mean, that album I made very, very quickly, and it was mostly done by the time I introduced any other people to the recording process. So the songs are still, you know, mostly me or whatever. But when we were doing that, we were like, man, we gotta, like, actually make some shit together. And she works at a really cool studio in Detroit called Assemble. And she had, Assemble had basically rented out a whole floor of this office tower right near downtown. They set up the different rooms. It was set up with office cubicles, you know. And they set it up with drums in there and like speakers and everything. So we went in and we wrote and recorded that song in like 2 days, which is pretty quick.
Even. That's pretty impressive. Yeah.
Like it was basically like I mixed it later, but it was basically done. Yeah. I mean, she's so amazing. Like we went in and had immediately kind of like the kind of collaborative vibes that I really have like only experienced a couple times. Where you can just sit down with somebody, start playing something, and they'll generate ideas in the room with you. Like, we're not like, hey, I made this the other day. It's like, keep playing this part, and I'm going to sing over top of it. And, you know, I used to do that with my brother, like, when we were in high school. I haven't really collaborated with many people like that.
Are you hinting at more collaboration with her? Is that what you're saying?
100%. I actually just sent her some more tracks like last week.
Oh,
but
perfect.
The only thing is I can't get into America and she can't get into Canada because of the stupid virus.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would love to collab with her more for sure. I think we'll be able to do it. But as with everything, everything's just kind of on hold right now, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I listened to some of her own stuff. Mm.
She hasn't released a ton of stuff yet.
But. Yeah, there's only like three songs in her SoundCloud, but the one I listened to sounds like an 80s synth pop rock ballad,
like a
Michael Bolton kind of thing. So she's got an incredible voice.
I think she just hit me up when I was living there. In Hamtramck, she just hit me up and was like, "Hey, like I heard like we hadn't even met before," and she just. So like I heard your production or whatever, and like I was wondering if you wanted to mix some stuff of mine or produce some stuff of mine. And then I listened to her stuff and I was like, whoa, damn, like there's not a lot of other people who are into, you know, like 80s style production in that way. Like there's a particular drum sound that I like. It's mostly like Lynn drums and stuff like that. And even though there's tons of synth pop around right now, I feel like There's a legit 80s vibe that doesn't seem to get floated around very much. I played some shows with this band Video Age that also kind of
Dude, we love Video Age.
Yeah, yeah, they're sick. I played some shows with them last year and I was kind of like, I think you guys also get that like there's a production associated with this. Mm-hmm. that is important. Like the production is as important as the songwriting.
The Midwest really attaches to that, actually. I find that like a lot of DIY bands in Chicago are, you know, they're trying to capitalize on like our generation's pretty nostalgia base and same with your generation, even though we're not that far apart. And they're not just like, oh, let's make something that sounds like something from the 80s. They'll go online and they'll buy equipment from the 80s so they could just make music way.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. There's, I mean, I think about that a lot when I'm working on music. Like they're, is something more than just like being influenced or like, you know, stealing from other people's ideas. There's something about like combining things in a way that could only be done after the fact. Right. Mm-hmm. So especially with a lot of like 80s, like underground music that I like, it was just like not popular at the time. And a lot of the artists who were making kind of like weird synth pop and stuff, especially when they're in different countries, like coming from like Italy or like Ukraine or something, these artists' work can be, I guess, experienced after the fact or more contextualized after the fact in a different way than it was at the time. So like something that might've been cheesy at the time sounds kind of fresh right now. and something that at the time sounded really like self-important or like maybe vital can kind of sound dated right now. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, there's stuff that was considered like very, you know, like critically acclaimed music from that period of time that I feel like just did not stand the test of time. And like, I'm over here like listening to some like Italo disco that was like trash at the mm-hmm. time and being like, I think this makes more, like this seems like raw. And when people put on, when people like play some kind of like raw Italo stuff, I feel like that takes it to, or like Newbie, like from Belgium. I feel like that gets to me in a way that it probably didn't at the time for people. Because at the time, I mean, a lot of people just didn't really consider electronic music to be valid, you know, like they were.
Yeah.
I think at the time, like even, maybe particularly in North America, because there was sort of an anti-disco movement that was like totally racist.
Yeah. I got a story about that. Yeah, but go ahead. Oh,
yeah. Well, yeah, you're in Chicago. It was the epicenter of that.
Yeah, I have a t-shirt. Have you ever heard of Disco Demolition?
Was that the thing in the stadium with the,
yeah.
the blowing up? Yeah.
So I went to a White Sox game with my dad last year, and it was like sponsored by somebody he works with. So, you know, like we got in, we were in the bleachers, and we went. It was the anniversary of Disco Demolition.
Crazy.
What's even crazier is like, obviously everybody knows that to be a really racist thing that happens. And they were handing out to the first 20,000 people who showed up free t-shirts commemorating Disco Demolition. And so I have a t-shirt in my closet that's like the anniversary of Disco Demolition. And it's a cool t-shirt. And when I wear it, like it's like a protest to Disco Demolition.
Yeah.
I fucking love this music. Like something like this is like, there's a lot of people in Hip Dad Radio with a lot of different tastes in music, but I think every single one of us has an appreciation for disco.
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember at the party, you guys were playing really cool records for sure. Mm-hmm. Like disco sucks, you know, like that's a ridiculous thing that happened. And I think that in America, like, cause Europe obviously has a different attitude towards dance music and electronic music. But I feel like in America, that really kind of killed the vibe for a lot of people. Like there's artists who were making, like Patrick Cowley, who were making like super groundbreaking synth based music that I think is only being widely appreciated now. It's like, yeah, I mean, the whole thing's just stupid. I can't believe that like a musical movement that's so based in celebration and being open-minded and stuff, to have it kind of like shut down like that. And even now it's like, I kind of feel like, you know, isn't it like kind of fucked up that like the most popular disco bands ever are like three white dudes from Australia and four white people from Sweden?
Mm-hmm. I'm with you, man.
Like that's pretty weird.
I think also, you know, disco obviously suffered from racism, but in the 80s and 90s, there was like this huge push towards like commercialization of things, like not necessarily like mm-hmm. in the way that the Beatles were commercialized, but that everything has to be catchy. And it's like big deal to get like real music in the soundtracks of movies and stuff like that. And so mm-hmm. a lot of the music that was produced back then that was being published and played on radio stations rather than disco music was like a lot of white artists working with people with synthesizers. And like, everybody's like, oh, this is groundbreaking. And to an extent it was, you know, like, I think it was definitely a revolution in the 80s of synths, but then you have people from Europe, from like Italy, like a guy like Giorgio Moroder,
mm-hmm. yeah, you know, for sure.
He wrote so much music that shows up in movies and like pop culture back then. Definitely. And I think it's the stuff that's like, what's the video? The Rick Rolling.
Yeah.
Like that song's immortalized, but stuff by guys like Giorgio Moroder is like kind of like underappreciated.
That's old school music industry was just like basically hella racist. The influence of black artists, I mean, it's everything. Like all the music that we listen to. Mm-hmm. And forever, up until the current day, it's just not given the attention that it deserves. And there are white artists that are, you know, like, it's tough because like you got somebody like who does the Rick Rolling thing? What's this?
I'm gonna Google it right now. I also don't know his name.
It's what's his fucking name?
Rick Astley.
Rick Astley, yeah, right.
Never going to give you up.
Rick Astley, you know, there's like Blue Eyed Soul, right? You know, there's a bunch of other artists that are white and made kind of like soul influenced music in the 80s that I think are really good. I mean, you could even say like something like Tears for Fears is kind of like inspired by that. But it's just that if you looked at the roster of the labels, there was like no representation by black artists at that time outside of the worlds of like R&B, which was radio stations classified that as black music.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like it's just, I don't know. The history of the music industry is frustrating for sure. Yeah.
Well, I would like to talk about these new mixes that you have that got released by Sobo, who I don't I don't know who Sobo is or what they are, or what they do, but
Sobo is Arbutus's sub label that does dance music specifically.
Gotcha.
So it's basically Seb who runs Arbutus, and then Pat who he DJs and produces is Patrick Holland, but up until very recently was going by Project Pablo, pretty well known DJ and producer. So they release a bunch of cool 12 inches. And yeah, I was like really flattered that they wanted to do one actually.
Yeah. So this came in after Voice of Lovers, right? So this got, you released Voice of Lovers, and what do? They approach you. They're like, hey, we want to do mixes of these songs and put them on a 12 inch.
Yeah. I had like, I do make a lot of music with remix stuff kind of in mind. Like I do, I mean, so much of my stuff is based on loops that all you really have to do is extend the loops and punch in different instruments and take out different instruments and you can make, I have edits that I play when I DJ of my own stuff that is just like extended versions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They wanted to just do like straight up remixes. And like, I mean, I know Pat pretty well, but like Cooper Saver and Dane, like I met Dane at a record store. But Cooper Saber, I've never even met, and I'm a huge fan. I love his DJ mixes. He's in LA. He's a DJ, and he puts on some parties there. And I was just a huge fan. So it was cool, like, communicating with him. And he sent back the track, which was a remix of a song called Free Time that I had made kind of as, like, it's kind of like a new beat influenced. Like, it's probably, like, the heaviest dance vibe track, but my version of it's only like 3 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And he made it into like the full dance extended version that it was sort of meant to be.
Yeah, it's like, I looked at it, it's like 6 or 7 minutes on Discogs, right?
And there was a video too that actually the guy Jordan who made the In and Out video, he made a video for that song for the remix too, of the same style with the, like, I mean, I don't know if it has a dog smoking weed, but it definitely has some like weird shit like that.
Mm-hmm.
Jordan's
it's pretty Jordan's trippy.
Yeah, for sure. Jordan's an absolute genius. Like he does a bunch of animated videos, and like it's crazy. Like when I talked to him about doing the In and Out video, he had only done one video before. Like he had only done one animation before.
Whoa.
And he sent me the In and Out thing, and I was like, "You mean like this is the second thing you've ever animated?" He was like, "Yeah, yeah, I'm just getting started."
Like, that's fucking awesome.
That's crazy, man. But yeah, he worked really hard, and I feel like I've been lucky with collaborators that people like Cooper Saver or Pat or Jordan or Kaylin, I've really had like a pleasant experience working with all of them, you know. And
were you involved in their mixing of your songs at all?
For the remix things?
Yeah.
No, not at all. I literally just was like, I mean, I might have had a couple of mixed notes, like being like, hey, like the hi-hat's too loud or whatever. But if that happened at all, like it was really minimal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do remixes myself sometimes too. So like, I definitely appreciate when somebody spent that much time on your thing. It's their project now, you know. Like I actually remixed my friend's band Doom Squad from Toronto, who are super good. I just did a remix for them, and it was like, it's basically just like their vocals, and then I just made an entirely new track. It's cool because I do feel like it's mine as well.
Awesome. Well, what's next for Moon King? More Vesper, more mixes? Should we be expecting an album sometime soon? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I luckily, you know, I can make music on my own. The COVID experience has mostly been pretty creative. I jumped into, well, actually, yeah, I mean, we haven't even talked about this, but like the weirdest thing about just from my personal experience of the pandemic was that I was in Detroit when it started, like in March. Mm-hmm. And I had planned on being there for, you know, like the foreseeable future. And as soon as the virus started to get really serious, I actually, you know, I was like, I think I'd basically have to go back to Canada. Like, it's not really safe. And I didn't know how bad things were going to get. So I hopped across, you know, Detroit is on the border of Canada. So I just hopped right across the border. And I found a place in Windsor, which is directly across the border, about 5 minutes away from Detroit, like literally 5 minutes on a bridge. And I found a place there and just basically holed up pretty much from then until now. And I, you know, I managed to make a bunch of music. I think I got an album. I'm not really sure yet. There's definitely an album's worth of stuff. I've got to spend some time with
it. That's awesome. Well, cool, man. Why don't you tell our audience where they can find you, what they should be looking up, what they should be buying?
Yeah, there is, I mean, you can just Google Moon King. All my stuff's on there. It's on Spotify. Instagram is Daniel Moon King. And happy to chat with people. I got lots of time. If you want to chat about music or something, just hit me up.
Awesome. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for tuning in. For more information on today's episode, click the link on your podcast players for our show notes. To stay up to date on everything Hip Dad Radio, follow us on Instagram @HipDadRadio. See you next time.